You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, also FM 90.9 HD2 and HD3. I'm meteorologist Ed Keezer, in on another role today than doing the weather forecast. It's another edition of Sky Guys, and joining me in the studio this afternoon is Dave Leak. He's the coordinator of the William M. Starkel Planetarium at Parkland College. Dave, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Ed. It's good to be here.
And our technical director this afternoon, Henry Frain, our producer for the Afternoon Magazine today, Martha Deal, and also involved with producing this program, Harriet Williamson. And we're glad to be back here. It's been a little while, and we're moving into a new season. So during the course of the show, we want you to be able to call in if you have any questions about the sky. This is the Sky Guys. That's what we call ourselves. And we're going to talk about meteorology, astronomy, just about anything related to the sky. So if you have any questions at all this afternoon, feel free to call us. Our telephone numbers are 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Or toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. And we will be taking calls here for about the next 40 minutes or so. So if you got any weather or astronomy questions, feel free to call us. And Dave, I guess the first thing I want to ask you, since we'll probably talk to each other if we don't get calls. That'll be boring, though, if that happens. But what's new in the sky? I think about the only thing I'm really noticing is a really bright object in the south sky. I think I know what it is, but that might be something worth talking about.
Yeah. In fact, that is the planet Jupiter that's there that brightens the south. In fact, tonight ought to be interesting because we're going to have a waxing gibbous moon just below and to the left of Jupiter. So you'll see both of them together tonight.
Okay, and I'm sure there's some people listening that don't know what a waxing gibbous moon is. So, or there's maybe some that have heard that are like, okay, gibbous means this, waxing, waning. Could you maybe explain
sure.
a little bit about the names of the moons?
Yeah, well, gibbous, I believe, means humpback. So compared to a first quarter moon, which is really what looks like a half moon with one half lit and one half dark. It's kind of not quite full. Between that first quarter and all the way to full, that's called the gibbous phase. And waxing means to increase. So as each day goes by, the moon is just you see a little bit more of the bright side.
So when you get back to the last quarter, toward the last quarter, is that a waning gibbous moon?
That's right. That's right.
And what's the term between the quarter and the new moon?
Those are your crescent phases.
Okay. So it's like weather. Sometimes there's terms that actually are not complicated. So it looks like a crescent, and that's the phase.
There you go.
Okay. Well, we have some calls already, so that is good. Our first caller today is calling all the way up from near Starved Rock State Park. It looks like we have a caller on line 4 from La Salle, Peru. Good afternoon, and welcome to Sky Guys on the Afternoon Magazine.
Good afternoon. I had a question. Skilling had something in the paper about sunspot activity in cooler weather, or lack of sunspot activity in cooler weather. Do you two have an opinion on that?
Well, my opinion on sunspots, and this is actually something that maybe both of us, one of the few things that we both have something to say about, I think in general, I'm not a big person in using sunspots for making weather forecasts on a regular basis. So that's something that there are sunspot cycles. They're very important in what we call space weather. When it's very active, of course, it can occasionally cause problems with even the electrical grid. I think in the future, sunspots are going to be much more of a factor than in the past because they do affect things such as cell phones and satellites and your ATM transactions, your credit card transactions, and all of that can be affected when there's high solar activity. So it's something that it is followed. There is actually a space weather group as part of the National Weather Service, now headquartered out in Boulder, Colorado. But as far as getting down to the weather here, I don't really look at the spots meaning too much. I guess with less solar output, that could lead to a bit of a cooler pattern globally over a few years. That's something the output of the sun, although pretty constant, isn't completely constant. That now we'll switch over to Dave for the rest of that. But
well, the only thing I'll add to that, I mean, I agree with Ed, but they did have a situation back in the late 1600s, and they now call it the Maunder minimum, where that we went through an extended period where there really wasn't any solar activity on the sun, and that's also a time when Europe went through what they're now calling the Little Ice Age.
Mm-hmm.
So now did the solar activity cause Little Ice Age? Well, there are links, but I think that's a topic for conversation today, that they're using satellite. We have the Ulysses probe going around the sun. We have our SOHO spacecraft that's out there, and I think they're taking more data and trying to make that link. So I think they do suspect there's a link, maybe more of on a climatological scale, not so much the day-to-day temperatures. And but I think that's something that's the topic for current research.
And what about the solar activity right now? Isn't it kind of down?
We think we've got past solar minimum, and it's kind of on the way back up again.
Okay.
So at one time we thought we'd reach solar minimum, and then the sun kind of flared up a little bit again. So the sine wave that you sometimes see as the sunspot cycle isn't a perfect sine wave.
And is that very recent?
Yeah, fairly recent, yeah. Now, I haven't looked in the last couple of days to see if there's any sunspots, but I don't think there's anything major out there.
Because I know going into summer it was pretty quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, does that help?
Yes. You're, I guess, pretty much on the same wavelength. He might have been.
Well, he's a good guy. I didn't read that column, but he's definitely a good source for meteorological information.
Right. All right. Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Have a good afternoon. Thanks for calling. And we now will move on to line one. We have a caller from Champaign. Welcome to Sky Guys on the Afternoon Magazine. Line one.
Hello?
Hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. This question is for Dave Leake. I was wondering what the pros and cons of refracting telescopes over reflecting telescopes and why refracting telescopes seems more expensive than reflecting telescopes?
Well, the for telescopes in general, the larger the lens or the mirror, the more you're going to be able to see just because you're collecting more light than your little bitty eyeballs do. The thing about expense, though, is just like if you wear glasses, obviously the light has to go through the glass, so you have to grind both sides of the lens, and doing that with a large piece of glass is just very, very expensive. It's fairly easy. We have some of my colleagues, we have amateur astronomers in town who are grinding their own mirrors and then getting them coated with a reflective surface. So it's relatively easy to do with mirrors. It's just much, much more difficult to do with lenses. So that's why large refractors cost so much more than reflecting telescopes.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for your call, and we move along now to line two, and we have a caller from Mattoon. Good afternoon, and welcome to Sky Guys.
Just a question and comment. Every fall, this time of the year or later, I keep hearing that the ocean currents in the Pacific or weather in the Pacific is going to tell us something about what kind of winter we're going to have, and I've heard in the past years, we're going to have a mild winter because of such and such in the Pacific. Is there any validity to this sort of thing?
Well, that would probably have to do with El Nino and La Nina more than anything else, and that is a condition in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of South America near the equator, and when the water temperatures are above average, it's El Nino. When the water temperatures are below average, it's La Nina. Last winter, we had La Nina. Now it's in a neutral phase. As far as our winter weather here, you'll hear a lot of people look at that and say, oh, this means X, Y, or Z for winter. And really, the only correlations I've ever seen that really stand out are if there is a strong El Nino, that means water temperature is much warmer than average in the equatorial Pacific, then the winter tends to be mild around here, and we tend to have half or less than half the average snowfall that we get in a typical winter. Now, we've had some winters without El Nino where it's been mild in recent years, but there's no good correlation really with the Pacific Ocean water temperature and our exact winter weather other than what I just stated about if it's a really strong El Nino. So it's one of those things where I think people are looking for the simple answer to a complicated problem. So it gets a lot of press, but I think it for this part of the world, based on the statistical studies I've looked at, there's really not a good correlation with just that and what ultimately occurs here.
Would it have more effect on Iowa and west of Iowa in that area?
Not really. When you look at the big picture, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, the Midwest Corn Belt area, if you will, there's not going to be much of a difference in that. The areas that are more impacted directly by that La Nina, El Nino cycle are areas closer to the Pacific Ocean and areas closer to the tropics. So in the U.S., an El Nino often does lead to a rather strong subtropical jet stream, which means stormier weather in the Gulf Coast states, for example. And sometimes when there's La Nina in the Pacific Ocean, it's a little bit quieter and sunnier down there. So your odds of a sunny vacation in the winter in Florida are better with La Nina than with an El Nino. But Iowa, not much different than Illinois when you get right down to it.
Is there any indication how it's going to be this fall out there?
Well, right now it's near neutral. It may go into a weak El Nino, but at this point we don't see anything that's going to be dramatic.
So it's pretty hard to really forecast a milder hard winter then.
Certainly. Anything going out months in advance is extremely hard to forecast and really inaccurate.
Can't depend on the old farmer's almanac.
Well, I say you might as well use that because it's going to be, at least you can get some other good information out of it and it doesn't cost a whole lot. So I always tell people if you need a long-range forecast, the old farmer's almanac's not a bad way to go, but you just can't bank on that or any other long-range forecast.
Hey,
that, thank you.
That or woolly worms, right?
Oh, don't go there. Don't start. You're listening to Sky Guys on the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. I'm meteorologist Ed Kieser, and I'm taking some of the weather questions. And with me, that other voice you just heard is Dave Leak. He's the coordinator of the William M. Starkel Planetarium at Parkland College, and he's taking the astronomy questions. And if you have any questions about anything you see in the sky, anything weather-related or astronomy-related, give us a call. Our phone numbers are 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. And, Dave, we have another caller on line three, and this person is from Three Rivers, Michigan, but I understand this person is on the road near Peru, Indiana. Hmm. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Dave, I do have a question for you related to a little higher up in the sky. I was wondering if there's any predicted meteorite activity of any significance in the next month or so this fall.
Meteorite activity? Well, I can tell you a little about meteor showers. Tough to tell when one of those things is going to hit, but it's interesting. Somebody had written an article. I just read that a couple of weeks ago about why all the meteor showers, or at least the potent ones, appear to be in the fall. I don't know if there's any reason for that or not, but of course we had the August Perseids, which are probably one of the best known showers of the year. Then we have the October Orionids, right around October 21st, October 22nd. Then there's the Leonids, which are around in mid-November. And then the Geminids, which are about mid-December, about December 14th. It's just usually it's pretty cold and people don't like to get out and watch those. The thing is, if I'm not mistaken, I think the moon is going to be kind of in a bad spot for just about all those. I remember it wasn't a great fall for meteor showers because the best viewing is when the sky is the darkest. And if the moon's there, it kind of brightens things up.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for the call.
Thanks for the call. And we're moving right along here. We just filled up the phone lines again. So
it's all that talk of La Nina. That's what did it.
Yeah, exactly. That does it every time. El Nino, La Nina and El Nino. Anyway, we have a few more on the line, so we'll just move right along here. And I believe our next caller is calling from Sycamore, Illinois, on line four. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. I have a question for your astronomer about binocular telescopes. I certainly enjoy looking through binoculars a lot more than a single spotting scope. And I understand that there are some pretty large dual optic systems out there now, and I'm wondering if either of you have looked through them and can comment on whether planetary observation is really enhanced by the use of stereo optics.
Well, I don't own one of those. I wish I did, but I don't. And I've only looked through one time, which was up at a gathering up near Kankakee called Astrofest. I don't know of anyone in this area that actually has one, at least in the Champaign-Urbana area. But there are binocular eyepieces, and it's really interesting looking at those. It's sort of you're using one telescope, but then you're able to use both eyes, and it kind of splits it into two. And that gives the moon a really neat appearance. As far as a binocular telescope, I would imagine that'd be just a phenomenal view, because not only are you collecting more light, the more light you collect, the better things are going to look, but being able to use both eyes. From a stereoscopic standpoint, of course, the farther your eyes are apart, the better things are going to look. And since you're looking at things that are really, really far away, I don't know if that comes into play too much, but the idea that you can use both eyes and the view, I'm sure, would be stupendous.
Okay. Well, I guess what I need to do is what you did, go to a star party and see if I can find one.
Yeah, there's a couple of good ones. I'm only real familiar with the ones in Illinois. The ones that our astronomy club guys like to go to is the one at Panther Creek. I think it's Jim Edgar Park over there, unless that's one of the ones they're closing. I don't know.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Anyway, they have a dark sky event there, and then there's a Prairie Skies Star Party and Astrofest up between here and Chicago.
Very good. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, and you're listening to Sky Guys on the Afternoon Magazine. I just looked up the absolute latest report on the El Nino situation, the new report just in as of late yesterday afternoon. Neutral conditions are present in the Pacific Ocean, and now it looks like maybe they'll stay neutral and not even go into the early stages of El Nino, at least not through the end of 2008 here. There were some signs of El Nino starting up a little bit in the eastern Pacific, but that's kind of leveled off. So lingering La Nina, not really going to El Nino yet. So for this winter, neutral conditions, which really... There's no signal at all. That means we could have just about anything. I can tell you it's very cold up in the northern parts of Canada right now. There is a lot of early season cold air up there, so I wouldn't be surprised if we get blasted at some point early on this fall. But anyway, we're not doing weather forecasting now. We're taking phone calls, and our next caller is on line one this afternoon, and this is a person calling on a cell phone. Welcome to Sky Guys on the Afternoon Magazine, line one.
Yes, thank you. I guess this might be a question for more Ed, and it's part question, part rant, maybe.
Oh, no.
How do you deal with people, otherwise educated people, that will make the comment, well, gee, it's awfully cold, so much for global warming?
Well, you know, that's one thing that bothers me in all directions. If it seems a lot, first of all, the whole climate change issue, the word climate is the first thing we ought to look at there. It's a long-term gradual change. And it's not equal everywhere on Earth, too. The climate changes at different rates and in different ways on Earth as a whole. But weather events, whether they be cold weather, which will make people say so much for global warming, or a strong storm, and people say, oh, well, because of global warming, we got a big hurricane. You can't attribute individual weather events to climate change. Now, if there's a pattern of a change of weather events over a long period of time, then the climate has changed, and that is climate change. And it's one of those things that you sometimes don't know until after it's happened for a while, such as a drought. The first day of a drought, you don't know you're in a drought. If it's dry for 3 months, you can go back and see when the drought began. So as far as individual weather events, it really does frustrate me when people just attribute it, either saying, there's an example of of global warming, or there's an example that global warming isn't happening. You know, both ways, I've heard individual weather events used to make an argument, and it just doesn't work because climate is a long-term proposition looking at weather data over a long period of time, a collection of weather events.
Well, thank you. Maybe that's just an argument for better overall science education.
Well, I think we need better science education. We need the best possible measuring of parameters so we have the best possible data which scientists can use to track what's going on. But I appreciate that, too.
Yeah.
I think Dave and I both will certainly vote for that.
Science education rules.
I know we both
want it to.
Well, Dave's full-time at Parkland College. I teach one class a semester in the fall and spring out there. And, yeah, we have a lot of students that I think are bright, but when it comes to science education, there seems to be a lot that have a lot lacking.
Science literacy is an issue we're looking at. Let's put it that way.
Well, I appreciate that call, and we're going to move on now to line two. We have a caller from somewhere in Indiana. Just says Indiana here. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hello. A few miles from that destitute university, Purdue, actually. yeah, really. Two questions, one for the astronomer and one for the meteorologist. I'm presuming the bright object I see in the southern sky is Jupiter.
If it's, due south, then yes.
Yeah. And I was just wondering if you could, how much longer it's going to hang out there. I mean, it must be close to the opposition or something. And I was wondering if you could, are we into the minus magnitude with it yet, or is it still this, like, 1 and 1.2 or something like that? Because it's certainly bright. Then the second question deals with tornadoes. I was wondering if the mechanics of tornado formation is the same for the cyclonic ones like we experience here in Illinois and Indiana as the ones that seem to come in on the backside of the hurricanes. They mentioned that a lot in the news this past few weeks with both hurricanes that they were concerned about. The aftermath would be the backside causing a lot of tornadoes and causing damage that way. And I just wondered if the mechanics is the same or close. Thanks a lot.
Okay, I'll take the tornado question first.
Sure, go ahead.
You're finding some information out about Jupiter, the specifics. In general, the mechanics are the same. Tornadoes come from thunderstorms. A hurricane is just a fast swirling mass of thunderstorms, and from hurricanes there are often tornadoes, and that's something that a lot of people don't really pay attention to. And even with a weaker hurricane, such as when Gustav made landfall, it was a Category 1, I believe, but there were still tornadoes in Mississippi and Louisiana. And oftentimes, as a hurricane is traveling northward, it would be on the northeast quadrant to the right of the center is where the tornadoes are more frequent. And basically, tornadoes develop in strong thunderstorms where the atmosphere is very unstable, which a hurricane has a lot of warm, humid air in it. So it's by definition very unstable there. And also you have to have a lot of spin or wind shear. Now, it's a little different with a hurricane because the hurricane itself thrives on a lack of strong winds aloft. But because there's so much spin within the hurricane, that gets some of the thunderstorms spinning to where they can produce tornadoes. Now, the caller mentioned cyclonic. Anything that rotates counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere is cyclonic. And most tornadoes, 99% or a little more of all tornadoes, are cyclonic. All hurricanes are cyclonic. Middle-latitude storms, low-pressure centers are all cyclonic. In the southern hemisphere, it would be clockwise. There are a few tornadoes that occur that are what we call anticyclonic tornadoes. They spin the other way, but that's usually when a thunderstorm splits, and you'll get a rotation of counterclockwise on one side and clockwise on the other. So anticyclonic tornadoes are pretty rare. I think the ones that occur in hurricanes would mostly, if not all, be cyclonic, as are most tornadoes in general. Again, 99% or so are cyclonic. So I hope that helps answer the question.
Yeah, and then
years.
Quickly on the Jupiter question, Jupiter is actually going to be with us through the end of the year. Right now, Jupiter is not setting till after 1 o'clock in the morning, but that'll be earlier and earlier as we go through the end of the year. And on we get to New Year's Eve, it's going to be right around 6 p.m., which is still a good hour or so after the sun is set. So we'll have Jupiter throughout the rest of the year. He threw out the term magnitude. That's how astronomers gauge the brightness of things. And without going into detail, think about it as a number line where the brighter the star has a smaller number. And the way I like to think about it is your football team. You want your football team to be number one.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that on the number line, we found there are some things that are brighter, such as Jupiter. So we kind of get into the negative numbers. And Jupiter is right about like negative 2.3, 2.4 right now. So, which just means it's pretty bright. It's Sun, Moon, and Venus would be the only things that'd be brighter.
And Venus, you can only see low in the sky right now.
Yeah, Venus has been kind of hiding out near the horizon as the sun sets, but it's going to be getting higher and a little brighter. So, as we go into the fall months, it's going to be a lot easier to see in the southwest.
And Mercury, is that able to be seen? Or?
Mercury's tough just because it's so close to the sun. And there is a good spot now actually in the evening sky, but it's still Mercury setting in the twilight. Probably the best chance to see Mercury later on this year is going to be just before Halloween, around the 20th or something like that. But that's in the morning sky, so they're going to have to keep your hours.
Yeah.
So you get up in the morning and...
That's if I'm on morning shift.
That's right.
Either Mike Soll or I will get to see Mercury.
There you go.
One of us, depending on what shift we're on then. Well, thank you for the call, and we're going to take a couple of calls in just a moment. We're about at the halfway point, a little past that, and just a reminder, you're listening to Sky Guys on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3. Dave Leake, coordinator of the William M. Starkle Planetarium at Parkland College, is joining me. I'm meteorologist Ed Kieser. We're talking about astronomy and weather on the Sky Guys on the Afternoon Magazine. And we invite you to call in if you have a question. Our numbers are 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. And we'll pick it up again here with a caller on line 3 from Batavia. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I got a couple of questions and a comment, actually. My question would be, NASA plans on putting another telescope in space, and I forget the name of it, but to take the place of the Hubble. My question to you guys on number one question would be, is it worth it? I mean, are you guys really, I mean, do you think it would be better off just basically sending... unmanned robot type, missiles in there instead of just using a telescope? Because, I saw the cost. I was watching NASA TV one time, and it was just astronomical, especially nowadays. I think I almost think it's not worth sending up and then repairing repairing, putting a new one up there or repairing the Hubble. And I'll stand by for the next one.
Well, Dave, you can take that one since that's the astronomy realm.
Yeah, and when you get into the is it worth it, I mean, I'll freely admit it's kind of an opinion question. But I think with all the astronomers we have here at the University of Illinois, I don't think anybody would scoff at the Hubble Space Telescope. I mean, it's just turned out some absolutely wonderful data. I mean, we've learned so much from the Hubble. In fact, if I might throw in just a little plug here, they're actually going to have the person that's in charge of the Office of Public Outreach at the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute right here at the University of Illinois on, I believe it's September 17th. He's going to be here and he's going to talk about the impact of Hubble and also show some of the more dramatic images. And, yeah, that's September 17th at 7 o'clock at the Fullinger Auditorium. And it's free, so that's the best thing. Now, as far as the replacement, you're talking about the James Webb Telescope, and hopefully they'll get that launched in 2013. This thing has got a much larger mirror. And the thing is, it's not going to orbit the Earth. They're going to actually put it out in... about a million miles or so out there. So we don't have to worry about the Earth getting in the way of observations. And when you look at actual dollars, I'm not going to fib about it. There's a lot of zeros in there. But if you consider what we get from these things, then, I mean, compare the cost of, say, the James Webb to a weapon system or something like that. And if you look at it, I don't have the actual numbers in front of me, but like NASA's budget is a fraction of 1% of the actual the entire budget for the nation. So,
my goodness, I'll tell you, I watched Michael Griffin take it. Excuse the expression, in his shorts, big time, in front of the board, because I get those channels, C-SPAN and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're going up against a committee or something. You know, I mean, there's people that are for NASA, and there's a lot of people that are dead set against it. And
that's true.
You know what? I'm for NASA. I grew up in an area where it was highly classified. I grew up in Lancaster, California. I don't know if you're aware of that, but where that's at. It's out in the desert, the high desert, but it's next to Edwards Air Force Base, and that's where they built the space shuttle, and that's where a lot of scientific work was going on in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and to this day it's still going on. But part of the thing is that I love about NASA is it throws the education network in there on
yes.
how to educate the kids and show them, get interested in astronomy and trying to be a scientist, a space scientist. The problem they keep having, and this is a big problem, there's a lot of people that are taking the retirement benefits and basically running with it, and basically they're losing a lot of their engineers, a lot of their science people. And there's nobody to replace them. And I don't know how you guys as professors or teachers can, kind of get the kids going and get more interested in it. I wished I'd have gotten more interested in it when I was younger, but now that I'm a little bit older, I have a chance to get more interested in it. I just think NASA in general does a heck of a job, but they don't get the recognition that needs to be. And I don't know, in the universities all over the country, why can't people spend a little bit more time and try and promote that through the government? I mean, at least get part of NASA to come down and speak to the people. And I basically grew up with the space race. So, to me, I love NASA. I mean, I grew up with that stuff with the moonshots and Gemini and all that. Dating myself, but...
Well, we're there, too.
Yeah, we're right there, too. In fact, that's probably why I'm in the position that I'm in, is because when I was in grade school, a teacher had the forethought to actually bring in a television, and we watched some of the moonshots right there in the classroom.
I had the same thing. And you know what? And the thing that was neat, when you're a kid growing up, I was fortunate to have the guy that was in charge of some of those space shots living down the street from me, a colonel, Vince Capasso. He was in charge of that. And I've met, people like Pappy Bowlington and Chuck Yeager and Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. I've had a chance to do that. I've got their autographs at home. And they're priceless. They might be not to a lot of other, especially younger generation, but I tell you what, we need to get back into it. Every time the space shuttle goes up, my heart is in my chest. It just goes up to my throat because I know people who worked on that thing, even though it's antiquated. But to me, it means Americana. We're in a bad situation with our economy right now, and I think if we were to focus that on building jobs in this space race thing, we could get people back to work. We could get the ingenuity we had in the 60s and the 70s. I just don't get it. Maybe you guys come up with something, but I enjoy the program, by the way. I'll let you guys
Thank
go.
You.
I know I'm long-winded. Thanks.
I'm right with you. I mean, that's in fact, Ed and I, since we both teach, that's kind of our job, is not just teaching about weather or astronomy, but it's the whole science literacy thing. And to me, one of the course objectives in all of our natural science courses at Parkland is just to get people excited about science. And it's not the easiest thing to do, but we're working on it. How's that?
And interesting, that's the second caller that's brought up science literacy
yes.
today. So
mm-hmm.
it seems to be a theme here on the Afternoon Magazine. You're listening to Sky Guys. I'm Ed Kieser along with Dave Leak. He's the coordinator of the planetarium at Parkland College, and I'm chief meteorologist at WILL. And we have a few more minutes left. If you have a question about the sky, weather-related, astronomy-related, you can call us at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And we're now going to go to a caller on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
A quick question, sunset question. The green flash, what is it, and is it something to look for here on the prairie, or is it just visible over the ocean?
I don't know. We might both be able to take that one. It's an atmospheric effect where, and I'll admit, I've never seen it before. It's best seen, I'm told, on cruises, and of course, I can't afford to do that. But you know, the when the sun sets and the blue light is scattered out, then that's why your sunsets look red. And there's also an effect when you get it really, really low that it also – the red light, the red part goes away, which all it leaves is the middle part of the spectrum, which is why you see that green flash. And I'm trying to remember what takes out the red. I know the blue is scattered out, and that's why we have blue skies. But that's really it, is when it gets really low like that, then you're taking out all the spectrum except for the green part in the middle.
It's very hard to see. I don't think I've really seen it. One time I thought I saw it, but I think it's one of those things I looked at the sun too much as it was setting. And, you know, the opposite of the red is green. And I think I was kind of – I don't think it really was the green flash. It's very hard to see. And as Dave noted, probably the best place is out on an ocean. I'm not going to say it's impossible to see it here in central Illinois, but it's – I don't know of anybody that has seen it.
No, I don't know of anyone either. There might be, but you couldn't do it with the crops up like this. You need a very, very, very flat horizon.
And when I took an optics class, well, in meteorology back many moons ago, the professor I had there was a really good professor for atmospheric optics, a person by the name of Alistair Fraser, and he said that the green flash was very hard to see, but the legend was that those that see the green flash do not err in the matters of love.
Oh.
That's something I remember from that class.
Well, that explains a lot.
So there you go. So.
Okay.
If you see it, I guess you're lucky.
Exactly. Well, thanks very much.
All right.
Good question.
Thanks for calling. And we are going to move along on the Sky Guys here. Dave, we've got a caller now from Champaign County on line two. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I don't want to go on and on about the space program or science education or science spending, but I think we should spend astronomical amounts on this, and I can suggest places where we could transfer the money from. But
I'm sure.
Question I have is rather of a bring down, so maybe I should have called it in earlier. I was talking to a fairly reliable guy who says that the latest positive feedback loop that people are talking about vis-a-vis global climate change disruption is if the glaciation is reduced in the poles, that it'll affect the albedo, the reflectivity of the upper atmosphere, and in a positive way, so that it will create more warmth and he says there are some people that think we're on a trajectory to being like Venus, which is about 800 degrees in the atmosphere at the ground level, I guess. So
I'll let this is an Ed question.
Thank you very much.
The only thing I'll throw in is that I know there are just so many factors that go into that. It's not just kind of like you talking about the El Nino and La Nina. So many things that that go into it, and it's not just one thing. So. Yeah, I've heard some people say, well, if it gets warmer, there'll be more evaporation, which means more clouds, and then it'll be cooler, won't it? And, I mean, go ahead. That's kind of a question.
Yeah, thanks for setting me up, Dave. Well, there's a lot of unknowns. I guess that's the way I'll frame this. There's a lot of unknowns, and that's why I'm very strongly in favor of making sure that there's enough funding for good science, because these questions are questions that everybody needs and wants answers to. And I think the best way to get the good answers is to have good science. And it's a very complicated problem, because you just mentioned the term feedback. And I think that a lot of people listening maybe don't really grasp what that means. And what that means is what Dave started to say. Okay, say the globe warms. That could lead to more evaporation. More evaporation means more water vapor in the atmosphere, which does absorb and emit infrared radiation, which would mean more warming. But it also would mean more clouds in some areas, which would then allow less sunlight into certain areas, so certain areas may cool. But then that may affect other weather patterns in other places, which could lead to warming in some places, cooling in others, probably an overall warming. But one thing leads to another, to another, to another, and those are the feedbacks. And they're very hard to that's what's really hard to come up with is the as to what will really happen if we do this. How will that affect that, which then affects the next thing and the next thing and the next thing? So some of the parameters are easy to measure, such as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has steadily gone up over the last 50 years. In Mauna Loa, Hawaii, good observations taken for more than 50 years now, and there's just been a steady increase. We know that that's a global greenhouse gas. Carbon dioxide's a gas that absorbs infrared radiation and emits back radiation toward the Earth's surface and has a net warming effect. But what does that mean compared to everything else? Then it gets more complicated. So I think what the caller has here is bringing up some concerns, most definitely, but I don't have the answers. And in fact, it's not my area of expertise. I'm an interested reader when I get the chance of what is being said. And I could tell you a lot of respected scientists have different theories on things and on what feedbacks will be the strongest or what results will be the strongest that will lead to other feedbacks. And probably, I'm guessing he's talked to some local scientists because we do have some local scientists mm-hmm. working on the global climate change issue. So I wish I could give more of a definitive answer than that, but that's about all I can give at this point and just say it's complicated and we need to study it more and make good decisions along the way. Well, thank you for your call, and I see there are no more callers online and we only have about a minute left. A couple things I want to mention. One thing is not weather-related, but here on WILL-TV tonight, there's a special program on Memorial Stadium. And
I'm looking forward to that.
Denise LaGrassa and John Paul and others put a lot of work into producing a show that I'm told is excellent. I plan to watch it myself. I haven't seen it yet, but that's coming up tonight at 7 p.m. on WILL-TV. Also this evening on campus, Professor Emeritus James Kaler will be giving his annual slide talk about the night sky and what it shows about the universe around us. And that will be tonight at 8 p.m. in room 141 of the Loomis Physics Building on the U of I campus. And that's sponsored by the Astronomical Society at the University of Illinois. And anything else?
I'd throw in that, of course, we're still doing planetarium shows on the weekends. We have them on Friday and Saturday nights now. We'll open our Fall Prairie Sky Show on the 19th, and our World of Science series is going to be starting soon. We'll have Joanne Manister here to talk about stem cells on October 3rd, and a lot of neat things going on this fall. So our schedule is linked off the off the Parkland College website, and we also have our 351-2446 hotline number.
In those World of Science lectures, since we're talking about science literacy, they're the first Friday of the month?
Yeah, first Friday of the month, starting in October at 7 o'clock. They're just a buck. We just kind of do it as a public service. And we've got a neat lineup this year. Jim Kaler will be there in December. We have a gentleman coming in November to talk about the Twin Groves Wind Farm that you can see north of Interstate 74.
Great. I know you were trying to get somebody from that last year.
Thanks to my wife. She's the person that put me into that contact.
Well, Dave, we're all out of time. Once again, the time went fast. We thank everybody that called this afternoon. And again, we want to thank our producers for the show, Martha Deal and Harriet Williamson, and our technical director, Henry Frayne. And with that concludes Sky Guys for this time around. We'll do it again sometime. Don't know when, just whenever it works out in the schedule.